Currently, our temperature outside is 14 degrees.
And good afternoon. It's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading, and we've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. And we'll be going to Ivanhoe in just a moment, but, well, we're at the point where Rebecca is being brought to trial by the Grand Master of the Order of Templars. The preceptor had hardly given the necessary orders when he was joined by... My apologies for that. The preceptor had hardly given the necessary orders when he was joined by Conrad Montfichet, who acquainted him with the Grand Master's resolution to bring the Jewess to instant trial for sorcery. "It is surely a dream," said the preceptor. "We have many Jewish physicians, and we call them not wizards, though they work wonderful cures." "The Grand Master thinks otherwise," said Montfichet. "And, Albert, I will be upright with you, wizard or not. It were better that this miserable damsel die than that Brian de Bois-Guilbert should be lost to the order, or the order divided by internal dissension. You know his high rank, his fame in arms. You know the zeal with which many of our brethren regard him. But all this will not avail him with our Grand Master, should he consider Brian as the accomplice, not the victim, of this Jewess. Were the souls of the 12 tribes in her single body, it were better she suffered alone than that Bois-Guilbert were partner in her destruction." "I have been working him even now to abandon her," said Malvoisin. "But still, are there grounds enough to condemn this Rebecca for sorcery? Will not the Grand Master change his mind when he sees that the proofs are so weak?" "They must be strengthened, Albert," replied Montfichet. "They must be strengthened. Do you understand me?" "I do," said the preceptor. "Nor do I scruple to do aught for advancement of the order, but there is little time to find engines fitting." "Malvoisin, they must be found," said Conrad. "Well, will it advantage both the order and you? This temple stow is a poor preceptory, that of Maison d'Eux is worth double its value. You know my interest with our old chief. Find those who can carry this matter through, and you are preceptor at Maison d'Eux in the fertile Kent. How say you?" "There is," replied Malvoisin, "among those who came hither with Bois-Guilbert, two fellows whom I know. Servants they were to my brother Philip de Valmoisin, and passed from his service to that of Frontibouf. It may be they know something of the witcheries of this woman. Well, away, seek them out instantly, and hark you, if a byzant or two will sharpen their memory, let them not be wanting." "Or they would swear that the mother that bore them a sorceress for a zecon," said the preceptor. "Away then," said Montfichet. "At noon the affair will proceed. I have not seen our senior in such earnest preparation since he condemned to the stake Hamet Alfagi, a convert who relapsed to the Muslim faith." The ponderous castle bell had tolled the point of noon when Rebecca heard a trampling of feet upon the private stair which led to her place of confinement. The noise announced the arrival of several persons, and the circumstance rather gave her joy, for she was more afraid of the solitary visits of the fierce and passionate Bois-Guilbert than of any evil that could befall her besides. The door of the chamber was unlocked, and Conrad and the preceptor Malvoisin entered, attended by four warders clothed in black and bearing halberds. "Daughter of an accursed race," said the preceptor, "arise and follow us."
"Where?" said Rebecca. "And why? What purpose?"
"Damsel," answered Conrad, "it is not for you to question, but to obey. Nevertheless, be it known to you that you are to be brought before the tribunal of the Grand Master of our holy order, there to answer for your offences."
"May the God of Abraham be praised," said Rebecca, folding her hands devoutly. "The name of a judge, though an enemy to my people, is to me the same as that of a protector. Most willingly do I follow you. Permit me only to wrap my veil around my head." They descended the stair with slow and solemn step,
traversed a long gallery, and by a pair of folding doors placed at the end, entered the great hall, in which the Grand Master had, for the time, established his court of justice. The lower part of this ample apartment was filled with squires and yeomen, who made way, not without some difficulty, for Rebecca, attended by the preceptor and Montfichet, and followed by the guard of halberdiers, to move forward to the seat appointed for her. As she passed through the crowd, her arms folded and her head depressed, a scrap of paper was thrust into her hand, which she received almost unconsciously, and continued to hold without examining its contents. The assurance that she possessed some kind of friend in this awful assembly gave her courage to look around and to mark into whose presence she had been conducted. She gazed accordingly upon the scene, which will be described in the next chapter. Chapter 37. The tribunal erected for the trial of the innocent and unhappy Rebecca occupied the dais or elevated part of the upper end of the great hall, a platform which we have already described as the place of honour, destined to be occupied by the most distinguished inhabitants or guests of an ancient mansion. On an elevated seat, directly before the accused, sat the Grand Master of the temple, in full and ample robes of flowing white, holding in his hand the mystic staff which bore the symbol of the order. At his feet was placed a table, occupied by two scribes, chaplains of the order, whose duty it was to reduce to formal record the proceedings of the day. The black dresses, bare scalps, and demure looks of these churchmen formed a strong contrast to the warlike appearance of the knights who attended, either as residing in the preceptory or as come hither to attend upon their Grand Master. The preceptors, of whom there were four present, occupied seats lower in height and somewhat drawn back, behind that of their superior, and the knights, who enjoyed no such rank in the order, were placed on benches still lower, and preserving the same distance from the preceptors as these from the Grand Master. Behind them, but still upon the dais, or elevated portion of the hall, stood the esquires of the order, in white dresses of an inferior quality. The whole assembly wore an aspect of the most profound gravity, and the faces of the knights might be perceived traces of military daring, united with the solemn carriage, becoming men of a religious profession, and which, in the presence of their Grand Master, failed not to sit upon every brow. The remaining and lower part of the hall was filled with guards holding partisans, and with other attendants whom curiosity had drawn here to see at once a Grand Master and a Jewish sorceress. By far the greater part of those inferior persons were, in one rank or other, connected with the order, and were accordingly distinguished by their black dresses. But peasants from the neighbouring country were not refused admittance, for it was the pride of Beaumanoir to render the edifying spectacle of the justice which he administered as public as possible. His large blue eyes seemed to expand as he gazed around the assembly, and his countenance appeared elated by the conscious dignity and imaginary merit of the part he was now about to perform. A psalm which he himself accompanied with a deep mellow voice, which age had not deprived of its powers, commenced the proceedings of the day, and the solemn sounds, Veniti exultimus domino, so often sung by the Templars before engaging with earthly adversaries, was judged by Lucas most appropriate to introduce the approaching triumph, for such he deemed it, over the powers of darkness. The deep, prolonged notes, raised by 100 masculine voices, accustomed to combine in the choral chant, arose to the vaulted roof of the hall, and rolled on amongst its arches with the pleasing yet solemn sound of the rushing of mighty waters. When the sound ceased, the Grand Master glanced his eye slowly around the circle, and observed that the seat of one of the preceptors was vacant. Brian de Bois-Guilbert, by whom it had been occupied, had left his place and was now standing near the extreme corner of one of the benches occupied by the knights companions of the temple, one hand extending his long mantle so as in some degree to hide his face, while the other held his cross-handled sword, the point of which, sheathed as it was, he was slowly drawing lines upon the oaken floor. "Unhappy man," said the Grand Master, after favouring him with a glance of compassion. "You see, Conrad, how this holy work distresses him. To this can the light look of woman, aided by the prince of the powers of this world, bring a valiant and worthy knight. See,
He cannot look upon us. He cannot look upon her. And who knows by what impulse from his tormentor his hand forms those cabalistic lines upon the floor? It may be our life and safety are thus aimed at, but we spit at and defy the foul enemy, Semper Leo Percutiator. This was the first communicated apart to his confidential follower, Conrad de Montfichet. The Grand Master then raised his voice and addressed the assembly. Reverend and valiant men, knights, preceptors and companions of this holy order, my brethren and my children, you also, well-born and pious esquires, who aspire to wear this holy cross, you also, Christian brethren of every degree, be it known to you that it is not defect of power in us which has occasioned the assembling of this congregation. For however unworthy in our person, yet to us is committed with this batoon full power to judge and to try all that regards the well of this our holy order. Holy Saint Bernard, in the rule of our knightly and religious profession, has said in the 59th verse that he would not that the brethren be called together in council save at the will and the command of the Master, leaving it free to us, as to those more worthy fathers who have preceded us in this our office, to judge as well of the occasion as of the time and place in which a chapter of the whole order or of any part thereof may be convoked. Also, in all such chapters, it is our duty to hear the advice of our brethren and to proceed according to our own pleasure. But when the raging wolf has made an inroad upon the flock and carried off one member thereof, it is the duty of the kind shepherd to call his comrades together, that with bows and slings they may quell the invader, according to our well-known rule, that the lion is ever to be beaten down. We have therefore summoned to our presence a Jewish woman by name of Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, a woman infamous for sortilages and for witcheries, whereby she has maddened the blood and besotted the brain, not of a churl, but of a knight, not of a secular knight, but of one devoted to the service of the holy temple, not of a knight companion, but of a preceptor of our order, first in honour as in place. Our brother Brian de Bois Guilbert is well known to ourselves and to all degrees who now hear me, as a true and zealous champion of the cross, by whose arm many deeds of valour have been wrought in the Holy Land, and the holy places purified from pollution by the blood of those infidels who defiled them. Neither have our brother's sagacity and prudence been less in repute among his brethren than his valour and discipline, insomuch that knights both in eastern and western lands have named de Bois Guilbert as one who may well be put in nomination as successor to this baton when it shall please heaven to release us from the toil of bearing it. If we were told that such a man, so honoured and so honourable, suddenly casting away regard for his character, his vows, his brethren, and his prospects, had associated himself, a Jewish damsel, wandered in this lewd company through solitary places, defended her person in preference to his own, and finally was so utterly blinded and besotted by his folly as to bring her even to one of our own preceptories, what should we say but that the noble knight was possessed by some evil demon or influenced by some wicked spell? If we could suppose it otherwise, think not rank, valour, high repute, or any earthly consideration should prevent us from visiting him with punishment, that the evil thing might be removed, even according to the text, Aferte malum ex vobis, for various and heinous are the acts of transgression against the rule of our blessed order in this lamentable history. First, he has walked according to his proper will, contrary to capital 33, quod nullus juxta proprium volitatem incidat. Second, he has held communication with an excommunicated person, capital 57, ut fratre non participent cum excommunicatus, and therefore has a portion in anathema maranatha. Third, he has conversed with strange women, contrary to the capital, ut fratre non conversantur cum extraneis mulieribus. Fourth, he has not avoided, nay, he has, it is to be feared, solicited the kiss of a woman. By which saith the last rule of our renowned order, ut fugiantur oscula. The soldiers of the cross are brought into a snare, for which heinous and multiplied guilt Brian de Bois-Guilbert should be cut off and cast out from our congregation, were he the right hand and the right eye thereof. He paused. A low murmur went through the assembly. Some of the younger part, who had been inclined to smile at the statute de osculus fugiendis, now became grave enough, and anxiously awaited that the Grand Master was next to propose. Such, he said, and so great should indeed be the punishment of a Knight Templar, who wilfully offended against the rules of his order in such weighty points. But if, by means of charms and spells, Satan had obtained dominion over the knight, perchance because he cast his eyes too lightly upon a damsel's beauty, we are then rather to lament than chastise his backsliding, and imposing on him only such penance as may purify him from his iniquity. We are to turn the full edge of our indignation upon the accursed instrument, which had so well nigh occasioned his utter falling away. Stand forth, therefore, and bear witness, you who have witnessed these unhappy doings, that we may judge of the sum and bearing thereof, and judge whether our justice may be satisfied with the punishment of this infidel woman, or if we must go on with a bleeding heart to the farther proceeding against our brother. Several witnesses were called to prove the risks to which Bois-Guilbert exposed himself in endeavouring to save Rebecca from the blazing castle, and his neglect of his personal defence in attending to her safety. The men gave these details with the exaggerations common to vulgar minds, which have been strongly excited by any remarkable event, and their natural disposition to the marvellous was greatly increased by the satisfaction which their evidence seemed to afford to the eminent person for whose information it had been delivered. Thus the dangers which Bois-Guilbert surmounted, in themselves sufficiently great, became portentous in their narrative. The devotion of the knight to Rebecca's defence was exaggerated beyond the bounds not only of discretion, but even of the most frantic excess of chivalrous zeal. And his deference to what she said, even though her language was often severe and upbraiding, was painted as carried to an excess, which in a man of his haughty temper seemed almost preternatural. The preceptor of Templestowe was then called on to describe the manner in which Bois-Guilbert and the Jewess arrived at the preceptory. The evidence of Malvoisin was skilful regarding the preceptory, but while he apparently studied to spare the feelings of Bois-Guilbert, he threw in, from time to time, such hints as seemed to infer that he laboured under some temporary alienation of mind, so deeply did he appear to be enamoured of the damsel whom he had brought along with him. With sighs of penitence, the preceptor avowed his own contrition for having admitted Rebecca and her lover within the walls of the preceptory. "But in my defence," he concluded, "has been made in my confession to our most reverend father, the Grand Master. He knows my motives were not evil, though my conduct may have been irregular. Joyfully I will submit to any penance he shall assign me." "You have spoken well, Brother Albert," said Beaumanoir. "Your motives were good, since you did judge it right to arrest your erring brother in his career of precipitate folly. But your conduct was wrong. As he that would stop a runaway steed, and seizing by the stirrup instead of the bridle, receives injury himself instead of accomplishing his purpose. 13 paternosters are assigned by our pious founder for matins, and 9 for vespers. Be those services doubled by you. Thrice a week a Templar is permitted to the use of flesh, but do you keep fast for all the 7 days. This do for 6 weeks to come, and your penance is accomplished." With a hypocritical look of the deepest submission, the preceptor of the temple stove bowed to the ground before his superior and resumed his seat. "Were it not well, brethren," said the Grand Master, "that we examine something into the former life and conversation of this woman, specially that we may discover whether she be one likely to use magical charms and spells, since the truths which we have heard may well incline us to suppose that in this unhappy course our erring brother has been acted upon by some infernal enticement and delusion." Herman of Goodwillrick was the fourth preceptor present. The other three were Conrad, Malvoisin, and Bois Guilbert himself. Herman was an ancient warrior, whose face was marked with scars, and these had been inflicted by the sabre of the Muslims, and he had great rank and consideration among his brethren. He rose and bowed to the Grand Master, who instantly granted him license of speech.
"I would crave to know, most reverend father, of our valiant brother Brian de Bois Guilbert, what he says to these wondrous accusations, and with what eye he himself now regards his unhappy intercourse with this Jewish maiden?"
"Brian de Bois Guilbert," said the Grand Master, "you hear the question which our brother of Goodwillrick desires you should answer. I command you to reply to him." Bois Guilbert turned his head towards the Grand Master when thus addressed, and remained silent. "He is possessed by a dumb devil," said the Grand Master. "Avoid you, Satanus. Speak, Brian de Bois Guilbert, I conjure you by this symbol of our holy order." Bois Guilbert made an effort to suppress his rising scorn, his indignation, the expression of which he was well aware would have little availed him. "Brian de Bois Guilbert," he answered, "replies not, most reverend father, to such wild and vague charges. If his honour be impeached, he will defend it with his body and with that sword which has so often fought for Christendom." "We forgive you, brother Brian," said the Grand Master, "though that you have boasted your warlike achievements before us is a glorifying of your own deeds and comes of the enemy who tempts us to exalt our own worship. But you has our pardon, judging you speak less of your own suggestion than from the impulse of him who, by heaven's leave, we will quell and drive forth from our assembly." A glance of disdain flashed from the dark eyes of Bois Guilbert, but he made no reply. "And now," pursued the Grand Master, "since our brother Goodwillrick's question has thus been imperfectly answered, pursue we our quest, brethren, and with our patron's assistance we will search to the bottom of this mystery of iniquity. Let those who have aught witness and seen the life and conversation of this Jewish woman stand forth before us." There was a bustle in the lower part of the hall, and when the Grand Master inquired the reason, it was replied that there was in the crowd a bedridden man, whom the prisoner had restored to the perfect use of his limbs by a miraculous balsam. The poor peasant, a Saxon by birth, was dragged forward to the bar, terrified at the penal consequences which he might have incurred by the guilt of having been cured of the palsy by a Jewish damsel. Perfectly cured he certainly was not, for he supported himself forward on crutches to give evidence. Most unwilling was his testimony, and given with many tears, but he admitted that 2 years since, when residing at York, he was suddenly afflicted with a sore disease while labouring for Isaac the rich Jew in his vocation as a joiner, that he had been unable to stir from his bed until the remedies applied by Rebecca's directions, and especially a warming and spicy-smelling balsam, had in some degree restored him to the use of his limbs. Moreover, he said, she had given him a pot of that precious ointment, and furnished him with a piece of money withal to return to the house of his father near to Templestowe. "And may it please your gracious reverence," said the man,
I cannot think the damsel meant to harm me, though she has the ill hap to be a Jewess. For even when I used her remedy, I said the patter and the creed, and it never operated a whit less kindly. Peace, slave, said the Grand Master, and be gone. It well suits brutes like these to be tampering and tinkering with hellish curses, and to be giving your labour to the sons of mischief. I tell you the fiend can impose diseases for the very purpose of removing them, in order to bring into credit some diabolical fashion of cure. Have you that salve of which you speak? The peasant, fumbling in his bosom with a trembling hand, produced a small box bearing some Hebrew characters on the lid, which was, with most of the audience, a sure proof that the devil had stood chemist. Beaumanoir, after crossing himself, took the box into his hand, and, learned in most of the Eastern tongues, read with ease the motto on the lid. It was, "The lion of the tribe of Judah has conquered." "Strange powers of Satanus," said he, "which can convert scripture into blasphemy, mingling poison with our necessary food. Is there no leech here who can tell us the ingredients of this mystic unguent?" Two mediciners, as they called themselves, the one a monk, the other a barber, appeared and avouched they knew nothing of the materials except that they savoured of myrrh and camphire, which they took to be oriental herbs, but with the true professional hatred to a successful practitioner of their art, they insinuated that since the medicine was beyond their own knowledge, it must necessarily have been compounded from an unlawful and magical pharmacopoeia, since they themselves, though no conjurers, fully understood every branch of their art, so far as it might be exercised, with the good faith of a Christian. When this medical research was ended, the Saxon peasant desired humbly to have back the medicine which he had found so salutary. But the Grand Master frowned severely at the request. "What is your name, fellow?" said he to the cripple.
"Hig, son of Snell," answered the peasant.
"Then, Hig, son of Snell," said the Grand Master, "I tell you, it is better to be bedridden than to accept the benefit of unbelievers' medicine, that you may rise and walk. Better to despoil infidels of their treasure by the strong hand than to accept of them benevolent gifts or do them service for wages. Go you and do as I have said."
"Alack," said the peasant, "and it shall not displease your reverence. The lesson comes too late for me, for I am but a maimed man. But I will tell my two brethren who serve the rich rabbi Nathan ben Samuel that your mastership says it is more lawful to rob him than to render him faithful service." "Out with the prating villain," said Beaumanoir, who was not prepared to refute this practical application of his general rule. Hig, the son of Snell, withdrew into the crowd, but interested in the fate of his benefactress, lingered until he should learn her doom, even at the risk again of encountering the frown of that severe judge, the terror of which withered his very heart within him. At this period of the trial, the Grand Master commanded Rebecca to unveil herself. Opening her lips for the first time, she replied patiently, but with dignity, that it was not the wont of the daughters of her people to uncover their faces when alone in an assembly of strangers. The sweet tones of her voice and the softness of her reply impressed on the audience a sentiment of pity and sympathy. But Beaumanoir, in whose mind the suppression of each feeling of humanity which could interfere with his imagined duty was a virtue of itself, repeated his commands that his victim should be unveiled. The guards were about to remove her veil accordingly when she stood up before the Grand Master and said, "No, but for the love of your own daughters." "Oh, alas," she said, recollecting herself, "you have no daughters. Yet for the remembrance of your mothers, for the love of your sisters and of female decency, let me not be thus handled in your presence. It suits not a maiden to be disrobed by such rude grooms. I will obey you," she added with an expression of patient sorrow in her voice, which had almost melted the heart of Beaumanoir himself. "You are elders among your people. At your command I will show the features of an ill-fated maiden." She withdrew her veil and looked on them
with a countenance in which bashfulness contended with dignity. Her exceeding beauty excited a murmur of surprise, and the younger knights told each other, with their eyes in silent correspondence, that Brian's best apology was in the power of her real charms, rather than of imaginary witchcraft. But Hig, the son of Snell, felt most deeply the effect produced by the sight of the countenance of his benefactress.
"Let me go forth," he said to the warders at the door of the hall. "Let me go forth. To look at her again will kill me, for I have had a share in murdering her."
"Peace, poor man," said Rebecca when she heard his exclamation. "You have done me no harm by speaking the truth. You cannot aid me by your complaints or lamentations. Peace, I pray you. Go home. Save yourself." Hig was about to be thrust out by the compassion of the warders, who were apprehensive lest his clamorous grief should draw upon them reprehension, and upon himself punishment. But he promised to be silent, and was permitted to remain. The two men-at-arms with whom Albert Malvoisin had not failed to communicate upon the import of their testimony were now called forward. Though both were hardened and inflexible villains, the sight of the captive maiden, as well as her excelling beauty, at first appeared to stagger them. But an expressive glance from the preceptor of Templestowe restored them to their dogged composure, and they delivered, with a precision which would have seemed suspicious to more impartial judges, circumstances altogether fictitious or trivial, and natural in themselves, but rendered pregnant with suspicion by the exaggerated manner in which they were told, and the sinister commentary which the witnesses added to the facts. The circumstances of their evidence would have been in modern days divided into two classes, those which were immaterial and those which were actually and physically impossible. But both were in those ignorant and superstitious times easily credited as proofs of guilt. The first class set forth that Rebecca was heard to mutter to herself in an unknown tongue, that the songs she sung by fits were of a strangely sweet sound, which made the ears of the hearer tingle and his heart throb, that she spoke at times to herself and seemed to look upward for a reply, that her garments were of strange and mystic form, unlike those of women of good repute, and that she had rings impressed with cabalistical devices, and that strange characters were embroidered on her veil. All these circumstances, so natural and so trivial, were gravely listened to as proofs, or at least as affording strong suspicions, that Rebecca had lawful correspondence with mystical powers. But there was less equivocal testimony, which the credulity of the assembly, or of the greater part, greedily swallowed, however incredible. One of the soldiers had seen her work a cure upon a wounded man, brought with them to the castle of Torkelston. She did, he said, make certain signs upon the wound, and repeated certain mysterious words, which he blessed God he understood not, when the iron head of a square crossbow bolt disengaged itself from the wound. The bleeding was staunched, the wound was closed, and the dying man was, within a quarter of an hour, walking upon the ramparts and assisting the witness in managing a mangonel or machine for hurling stones. This legend was probably founded upon the fact that Rebecca had attended on the wounded Ivanhoe when in the castle of Torkelston. But it was the more difficult to dispute the accuracy of the witness, as in order to produce real evidence in support of his verbal testimony, he drew from his pouch the very bolt head, which, according to his story, had been miraculously extracted from the wound. And as the iron weighed a full ounce, it completely confirmed the tale, however miraculous. His comrade had been witness from a neighbouring battlement of the scene between Rebecca and Bois Guilbert when she was upon the point of precipitating herself from the top of the tower. Not to be behind his companion, the fellow stated that he had seen Rebecca perch herself upon the parapet of the turret and there take the form of a milk-white swan, under which appearance she flitted three times around the castle of Torkelston, then again settle on the turret and once more assume the female form. Less than one half of this weighty evidence would have been sufficient to convict any old woman, poor and ugly, even though she had not been a Jewess. United with that fatal circumstance, the body of proof was too weighty for Rebecca's youth, though combined with that of the most exquisite beauty. The Grand Master had collected the suffrages, and now, in a solemn tone, demanded of Rebecca what she had to say against the sentence of condemnation which he was about to pronounce. "To invoke your pity," said the lovely Jewess with a voice tremulous with emotion, "would, I am aware, be as useless as I should hold it mean, to state that to relieve the sick and wounded of another religion cannot be displeasing to the acknowledged founder of both our faiths, were also unavailing to plead that many things which these men, whom may heaven pardon, have spoken against me, are impossible, would avail me but little, since you believe in their possibility, and still less would it advantage me to explain that the peculiarities of my dress, language, and manners, those of my people, I had well nigh said of my country, but alas, we have no country. Nor will I even vindicate myself at the expense of my oppressor, who stands there listening to the fictions and surmises which seem to convert the tyrant into the victim. God be judge between him and me. But rather I would submit to 10 such deaths as your pleasure may denounce against me, than listen to the suit of which that man Belial has urged upon me, friendless, defenceless, his prisoner. But he is of your own faith, and his lightest affirmation would weigh down the most solemn protestation of the distressed Jewess. I will not therefore return to himself the charges brought against me, but to himself, yes, Brian de Bois-Guilbert, to yourself I appeal, whether these accusations are not false, as monstrous and calumnious as they are deadly." There was a pause. All eyes turned to Brian de Bois-Guilbert. He was silent. "Speak," she said. "If you are a man, if you are a Christian, speak. I conjure you by the habit which you do wear, by the name you do inherit, by the knighthood you do vaunt, by the honour of your mother, by the tomb and bones of your father, I conjure you to say, are these things true?" "Answer her, brother," said the Grand Master, "if the enemy with whom you do wrestle will give you the power." In fact, Bois-Guilbert seemed agitated by contending passions which almost convulsed his features, and it was with a constrained voice that at last he replied, looking to Rebecca, "The scroll! The scroll!" "Aye," said Beaumanoir, "this is indeed testimony. The victim of her witcheries can only name the fatal scroll, the spell inscribed on which is doubtless the cause of his silence." But Rebecca put another interpretation on the words, extorted as it were from Bois-Guilbert, and glancing her eyes upon the slip of parchment, which she continued to hold in her hand, she read written thereupon in the Arabian character, "Demand a champion." The murmuring commentary which ran through the assembly at the strange reply of Bois-Guilbert gave Rebecca leisure to examine and instantly destroy the scroll unobserved. When the whispers had ceased, the Grand Master spoke. "Rebecca, you can derive no benefit from the evidence of this unhappy knight, for whom, as we well perceive, the enemy is yet too powerful. Have you anything else to say?"
"There is but one chance of life left to me," said Rebecca. "Even by your own fierce laws, life has been miserable, miserable at least of late. But I will not cast away the gift of God while he affords me the means of defending it. I deny this charge. I maintain my innocence, and I declare the falsehood of this accusation. I challenge the privilege of trial by combat, and will appear by my champion."
"And who, Rebecca," replied the Grand Master, "will lay lance in rest for a sorceress? Who will be the champion of a Jewess?"
"God will raise me up a champion," said Rebecca. "It cannot be that in merry England, the hospitable, the generous, the free, where so many are ready to peril their lives for honour, there will not be found one to fight for justice. But it is enough that I challenge the trial by combat. There lies my glove." She took her embroidered glove from her hand and flung it down before the Grand Master with an air of mingled simplicity and dignity, which excited universal surprise and indeed imagination. Well, where will a champion come from? What will Malvoisin do? Bois-Guilbert, difficult position, and the Grand Master. What will he have to say?
next week. Keep well, Braidwood.